JG 1.
Number 3B.
As we go on, Dick had a nice question that he asked, and we talked out the answer together before during the break. And I wanted him to ask the question again because it's something that we may have on our minds if we have also read some of these books in the world. And Dick, what? Just formulate your question again because I thought it was very good.
Well, I was considering how Rupert Sheldrake's hypotheses of formative causation and morphogenic fields would square with his further concept of the future is now.
Yes. Dick is asking, you know, Rupert Sheldrake, as Max has talked about, his...
Please take the pressure.
Yeah. Dick's question is... Rupert Sheldrake wrote a book called The Past Is Now, talking about the past is present.
The presence
of the past, that's right. And it was the concept of formative causation or the morphogenetic fields. And Dick wonders how Sheldrake's concept of morphogenetic fields and formative causation, how that stands in light of this work with the future is now. Because basically his work involves that the past is now, and the past determines the now, which is really also the work of of course, Mrs. Eddy, when she worked with that whole mortal mind in its individual, collective, and universal unconscious, determining our experience on the mental realm. And then Carl Jung, the Jungian, who worked went on into Jungian psychology. Carl Jung, a psychologist, showed us that our consciousness is being thought by archetypal beliefs. Certain individual, universal, and collective beliefs think man, and that the universal beliefs control the individual beliefs, control the collective. And Rupert Sheldrake went on to say that there is this morphogenetic field of which determines the now, this kind of reservoir of information in the genes and programmed in the genetic structure that is determining who we are and what we are. And this is just a field of information that comes along with man. So more or less, in a nutshell, it's the past determining the now. Well, actually, it's Rupert Sheldrake who is asking for the new hypothesis that the future determines the now, because he's saying, yes, I know the past determines the now, but how do you get out of those laws of limitation? How do we get out of that morphogenetic field that is determining what we are? And he has been doing a lot of work with... the Institute of Noetic Science and Harman, and he's part of that group that is asking for a formulation of the new laws of causation in order to get us out of the laws of limitation, which happen when just the past determines the now. So it's a forward development that is occurring. And as Dick went on to say, and we were talking together, when you have the past determining the now in the human mentality, and they're now asking to how you get out of that, and they see the only way you get out of it is let the higher order or the future determine the now, then if the past is now and the future is now, there's only the now, of which Jesus said. And that's what they're finally driving at. Now, just building the subject up for our common language, therefore, this initial cause or initial condition of all scientific discoveries, how we're being thought by God, how ideas come to us, has always been called what they see in scientists, intuition. Or they say, I had a vision, or I dreamed something, huh? It needn't have to be asleep. It could just be, say, I was walking along thinking of nothing, and suddenly the idea came. Actually, there was a study in the United States where 83% of the research scientists credited unconscious intuition in helping with their work. 83%. That said, ideas come to them. And their method of discovery is usually studying their field like Einstein did, learn the fundamentals, build on the shoulder of giants, learn all the basics of the subject, which Einstein would have learned the basic of the mechanistic universe of Newton, and he would have gone over and over all that Newton and those that went before Newton knew. He went over it and over it and over it. And then they would say they just let it go. Or if they're working on a problem, they say they'll work on it, and let it go and go out for a walk. Or go out and weed the garden. And they say it's usually while they're doing something else that the idea comes. Again, fortune favors the prepared mind. It isn't that any of us could suddenly discover E equals MC squared. The equality of matter and energy through intuition, as Einstein says he did. And yet, he was totally prepared for that intuitive glimpse that was coming. The idea was coming. It was sweeping down the century. He was prepared to get it. And so Einstein says that there is no logical way to the discovery of the elementary laws. I mean, this doesn't make sense, does it? You would think in our old paradigm, you'll think, but the old paradigm has everything to do with logic and reasoning from premise to conclusion. But we're talking about the initial discovery. He says there's only the way of intuition, but intuition must stand the test of logic. Now, this is the same as Mrs. Eddy. She says, I discovered Christian Science in a flash. You know, she was on her bed with the claim of death upon her in 1866 when she fell on the ice. And she tells us in the sixth chapter, near Death Valley, I learned these truths in a flash of revelation that all life was in and of spirit here and now. That came as a flash. And then she said, but I must know the science of it. I must know the logic behind that discovery that life is in and of spirit. So her revelation had to stand the test of science and logic. So it doesn't mean that logic is thrown out of the window and all we do is go on intuition. It means that intuition is reasoned out logically through the method of science. So, therefore, at its deepest level, we'll see that revelation and logic must coincide. That's what Mrs. Eddy says, that reason and revelation in the end coincide. What we have gotten through intuition can be logically explained through science. Yes, and the other point here I wanted to bring out, which is at the bottom of this, transparency. What is our responsibility into this fantastic premise that there is a superhuman prime information field or a creative logos which is evolving a science of all sciences through its self-generating laws? What is our responsibility in all of this? Are we just innocent bystander? There's a wonderful movie out. Did you see the movie called Mind Walk? Oh my, if it ever comes back. Fritjof Capra's brother produced it. Fritjof Capra, the fellow writing the book on Tao of Physics, his brother produced this movie called Mind Walk, and it premiered in Seattle and a few other cities, but it did come to LA afterwards. I think I saw it three times. It was so good. I can still hear the fellow saying in there, and now what is our responsibility within this huge quantum physics universe of non-linear self-generating truths? Because you think, is it fatalistic? Do we do nothing but live, drink, and be merry? No. Our responsibility, as Christianity has always shown us, and as Paul showed us when he was teaching, we live by grace. Paul went out to say, we live by this logos that comes to us. And, so the people misunderstood it, and they rushed off and just live, drink, and be merry. Tomorrow we die. We can't help it anyhow. They took on the belief of fatalism. So he had a fight against this belief in fatalism and says, no, our responsibility is to respond. And as Mrs. Eddy said, we respond by thought accepts the divine infinite calculus. That's no little, that's not easy, is it, Janine? Janine and I had a nice conversation in the middle of the break where she said, this isn't easy. No, it isn't easy to respond. Our responsibility is the hardest. The easiest part is to get the sudden inspiration, the getting the sudden high feeling. That's easy. The digestion's bitter. Taking it, this little book, pondering and eating it, Mrs. Eddy said, that's not easy to get ourselves out of the way and let that goal-motivated cybernetic system operate in our life without our human opinion about what we think. We're always convinced you're right, you know. I mean, I always thought I was right, and I'm sure you always felt you were right in telling people, other people besides ourselves, what to do. And yet, over the years, you finally realize, my goodness, you know, we weren't, if we'd have said, told these people what to do, we'd just have ruined their lives. And if we'd have done what we wanted to do, it would ruin ours also. That God has another plan, and it's always what we don't want to do. Everything happens in our life which we don't want to have happen. We go into the job we don't want, we go into the relationships we don't want, or the relationships we have we like are taken away from us. We don't like that either. Everything is what we don't want, usually. And we have to eat that bitter cod liver oil or whatever, as Jesus had that bitter gall. But it's all for the maximum of good, to push us forward into life in and of spirit. Because what we want is usually to stay in the human, to take the spiritual and plaster it all over the human. Though we angelically say our goals were to move forward, they weren't. We liked it when life was going well in the human, when we had the good human relationships and the good marriages and the good businesses and all that. We would be happy to cement it into cement and stick there. We want that. But God says, no, I want you to go to the higher, into the spiritual realm, and it pushes us on, and we all go kicking. It does, but it means that we come out of the physical through the human. The human is transitional. It doesn't mean we can't have the good marriage life and the happiness in the human. That happens. If we're willingness to go forward through the evolution of God, therefore God only takes away that which is unuseful, never that which is useful. It will never injure our useful surroundings. Oh, but that's hard to see. We say, but it was useful. And God says, no, it wasn't. You have to go forward. But we say, but it was, but it isn't. But it was, and it isn't. We have this nice fight going on, like Paul, as Saul had with God in his days of persecuting Christians until he finally stopped the struggle. How long did it take Saul to change to Paul? 14 years or something? He saw in Damascus the Christ idea, and then for 7 years he worked with Jesus' disciples, and 7 more he went in on his own. I mean, this is a lot of years for a Saul to be transformed into a Paul. So our responsibility is to thought accept this divine infinite calculus, to accept the phase transition in our life, to accept that principle God is bringing to us what it is. Through the divine mind, we are open to the vision, and let God take us through the phase transition from Egypt through the wilderness into the promised land, from one order through chaos into the higher order. So it demands a new attitude. All those Christianity, that's man. See, the word is God's responsibility. We don't program being. God declares what God is through the word. God sets into motion what God is through the Christ and its translation and retranslation. We have nothing to do with the word or the Christ. It's only the outcome of Christianity is man, even in the focus of all this process. And there, man's role is to accept. It isn't to instigate or do anything. It's just to accept. But that needs quite an attitude. Therefore, the Beatitudes, huh? through having that openness and all those qualities of the Beatitudes, we have to have a new attitude towards life. And it's usually the bad attitude in us that gets us down. We all know that when life isn't going well and we're not happy, we know it's our attitude towards life. We're not grateful for life, truth, and love. Mrs. Eddy says in prayer, if we're not grateful for life, truth, and love, we're just a bunch of hypocrites. We can go on and say, I'm grateful for this little thing and that little thing in our life, but we have to be grateful for the eternal development of life, truth, and love. It's selfishness. We want everything for us and for our way and the way we want it, including myself. It's just hard, just plain hard for us. Mrs. Eddy says, the warfare with oneself is grand to accept, but the Christ is making us do it. If we don't do it willingly, we go kicking and screaming into the infinite because it will make us do it anyhow, whether we like it or not. It does it in spite of ourselves. But we have it through, when we come, as we'll see in the new physics, to that bifurcation point, where we'll be able to, at that point where we can either take this path or that path, and they fit it, in physics they call it, when they're working with all this phenomena, they see that there's always a critical point that comes along, and either something can go down one road or down the other road at the critical point or bifurcation point, which we call the critical 3.5 point. Either we have a certain amount of choices in this realm of indeterminism, this realm where God determines, not indeterminism, on a higher scale, God determines what we must do. Even within there are choices. There's an openness within the system. And either we can choose the path of suffering or science. We would never choose the path of suffering if we understood that there's this path of peace. Usually we choose the path of suffering through ignorance. We don't know we're choosing it. But that both of the paths converge to the same point. They both lead to the same goal. Whether you take this path or that way, you end up at the same point. You don't end up in hell and damnation. It's you will either take the path of suffering, which arrives at the ultimate goal of divine science, or the path of science itself. You know, we see that in the apocalypse. Mrs. Eddy, when Max took the chapter on the apocalypse along with Revelation, in there, Mrs. Eddy shows that we don't have to go through Armageddon. We don't have to choose the path of suffering, which will bring on the Armageddon and the big battle of truth versus air, the Michael battle, huh? That we can choose the Gabriel path, the path of science and peace, and that the battle of Armageddon does not have to be fought. If the world responds to this prime information field, this creative logos that wants to bring out the optimum solution of the unification of everything. They see it wants to unify everything into this harmonious system. But we don't know which way the world's going to go, either through Armageddon or through the Gabriel method of warfare, which is acceptance of the divine infinite calculus. It's the world is being pumped full of information of the goal of a holistic science, of holistic theology, of holistic medicine, of ecology, of watch out for the earth. We're on a critical balance here. If a butterfly shakes its wings, it affects the motion of the winds. That can send it into turbulence. They see, they call it the butterfly effect from that. That even a little butterfly doing this can send the whole thing into chaos in the weather, affect the condition. So that's that holographic theory, that every part is part of the whole. Huh? You can't touch a part unless it has its face within the whole. It's a structural problem. Every problem finds its place within the whole. So, therefore, we're a very much a key point within this being. We must respond, and if we respond holistically, the world, and it has the information to respond holistically, you see how today in our political structure, how the Americans and even in the European and the whole world is unhappy with this non-ecological consciousness, the self-interest. It wants to get in leaders that are interested in the holistic universe, not just foreign policy, but what goes on in the domestic and what goes on in the environment. All this holistic reasoning, you can see that the people want it. They want to choose the path of science and peace. But we're confused on which leader to choose that we think is going to lead us down the way. Well, the thing is, we have to trust the divine idea is going to bring it in spite of which leader we choose is going to have to go the way. We may go suffering. We're not guaranteed we won't. But whether it's through suffering or science, we're trying to get the one that's the most transparent to take us down the line of peace. But if we aren't so lucky, it may be suffering, but the goal still will come out of science. Do you see? So our response in the world is necessary. To me, and I think to you, it looks good. From what we just see in America, I see that people want to go forward with a holistic consciousness, with everything happening for the good of mankind. You see in the elections, even in Israel, the changeover, the prime minister there. The people are tired of war. They're tired of their sons going to war. I don't know the inner politics of Israel. I only know generally that there has been a switchover of prime ministers, generally because they're tired of war. They want to figure out another way, huh? They want the world of peace. Within. And all this trying to bring these Palestinians, everybody together at the table, this is all trying to get it to work together, huh? And the people want it. The grassroots want to respond. This is really great. So I have the feeling that, as Willis Harmon said, I wish I'd brought that article, he's the head of the Institute of Noetic Science. He said there, they asked him, what was the biggest discovery you've made recently? And he says, when I said yes to the universe, when I stopped struggling myself and responded with and accepted the peaceful, holistic, goal causality way of life and stopped the self-interest, egotistical way of going. Huh? When he got Willis out of the way. Well, look what he's done now for mankind in the Institute of Noetic Science. He's just been a genius in that field. In business, he's gone into the businesses and trying to bring now this holistic, non-linear, self-generative theories to business. Gosh, how it needs it. To corporations, how it needs it. Into education, how it needs it. Before Russia broke from communism into its state today, he was in Russia working 10, 12 years ago because he said yes to the universe. He accepted the way of science and peace. Therefore, the model of being has us in view. And this is what these scientists are excited about, is that this new science, this quantum physics, which is preaching, as we'll see at the beginning of the afternoon, this downward causation, they see that we're not left out of this self-operative universe, that man is there. Man is very much involved in the structure of reality because they see that, as I said, the structure of reality and the structure of consciousness is the same and the structure of nature is the same. We take an active participating role in this. It's called the participatory universe. It's the anthropic principle where man does become involved. John Wheeler is one of them that's talking about this anthropic principle where they see then, and one of them also is Carl Jasper, a scientist, showing that science today has a prerequisite for the scientists to achieve a transcendent awareness. See, they're talking about our attitude, our awareness of the scientist. They say, all this new downward causation coming does something to us. And they say, anyhow, it's okay that we have to transcend our old self-interest because we're not from this planet anyhow. They say, it is part, Jasper says, It is part of man's nature. Instead of understanding ourselves as of this world, there is something in us that can stand opposed to it. If we are in this world from elsewhere, then we have in this world a task beyond it. Meaning we must transcend any laws of limitation in saying that we have to let the past determine the now, that we can look forward and let the future determine the now. We can transcend our old world views, and we can become out of normal science through the anomalies into extraordinary science. We can transcend ourselves. Jasper John and them showed that Jesus did it when he said that we are in the world, but we're not of it, and that we must form a comprehensive consciousness in order to realize that through our individual self-realization of our oneness with God, we can transform and let God transform us into one harmonious, integrated mankind, which is the goal. But that isn't communism, as people fear. That is not anything to do with any ism or ology, not a democracy, which is mob rule. It's theocracy. Man governed by his principle is self-governed. Therefore, when we talk about this harmonious, integrated world, it's not democracy, as the world is coming into, out of autocracy into democracy, which is okay. But who always says the mob is right? Often, it's where truth leads. Mrs. Eddy says, you can always tell where truth leads by the fewness but faithfulness of the followers. It's not where all the herd is, where the idea often is. It's where the few little are still working at it quietly and diligently is where we'll find the truth. But therefore, truth is transforming man from mob rule of democracy into theocracy, where the individual identifying itself with God is related to everything else. It's self-government. When man is governed by principle, he's self-governed, and we're all governed by God. If I let God govern my life, and you let God govern your life, and all mankind lets God govern their life, and the whole universe lets God govern their life, if we're all God idea, we're all integrated through God, huh? But our responsibility is to make sure we're a transparent, holographic idea. And when we're transparent to God and everybody else is transparent to God, that becomes an interrelationship, all hinging on God. That's where that universal reflection comes. So it's through individual self-realization we're transformed into one harmonious, integrated mankind where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts in this universal realm of divine science, the all in all. So the individual isn't lost in the collective. The individual is very much there serving a collective idea. It's so different than collectivism or communism. It's not what we're talking about.